folks. This is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCrit Podcast. So today we're joined by someone I've wanted to get on the show for a long time. Why don't I just let him introduce himself?
So I'm Karen Brohey. I'm a consultant in trauma and vascular surgery at Barts Health, which is in East London. And I work at the Royal London Hospital Major Trauma Centre. And I'm also Professor of Trauma Sciences at Queen Mary University of London.
And you're also, I believe, the creator and steward of the trauma.org site, correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's been going for 17 years now.
It's really a fantastic resource. For anyone who hasn't checked it out, just go over there because there's so much good stuff there. I was going to ask you countless questions, and then luckily you put up the Masters in Trauma lecture on your site, which I'm just going to direct people to, and then we could get into the nitty-gritty instead of having to go through the basics.
Yeah, sure.
So what I'm talking about, folks, is I was going to interview Karim about hypotensive resuscitation, but just recently he started offering a Masters in Trauma Science class, and he, out of the goodness of his heart, has posted the lectures for that master's, and one of them was on hypotensive resuscitation. So I'm going to put that in the show notes. Just go to mcrit.org and look for episode 81. Check out that lecture for the basics, and now we're just going to go a little bit more in depth. So you mentioned this study that came out of Texas, which they released just their preliminary results, but it's finally giving us an answer as to what map we should be shooting at. So if you went into the trauma bay today, what map are you taking your severe hemorrhagic shock patients to?
So I don't really use MAPs or blood pressures at all in these patients, I have to say. I think it's focusing on a blood pressure is not really helpful in the management of these patients. And I think permissive hypotension should be more of a philosophy than a goal or a target. I think you need some blood pressure. If you have too little for too long, bad things happen to you. But if you try and resuscitate to pressures that are normal, then I think, you know, you end up doing bad things to patients, and you end up in unsalvageable situations for all sorts of reasons. So are there levels that I get worried about? Yes, I think if I'm seeing patients with pressures, of systolic pressures, this is of 60, 70, then we'll tend to give a judicious bit of fluid. On the other hand, if patients are running around 80 to 90, then we'll hold off. But we don't have arguments about this in front of patients, you know, and we don't target specific blood pressures. It's really more of this patient's not responding. We need to go to surgery. Any fluids that we're going to give is going to be either, blood or a product, and we're going to get hemorrhage control as quickly as possible and just try and maintain an appropriate pressure in that patient. I think it's very hard on the basis of current evidence to pick a map and say, this is the one.
But what we could say, I think you'd agree, is that we should not be shooting for normal maps until we get control of the hemorrhage.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's, it's interesting. It's, I was talking to somebody the other day, and, you know, vascular surgery has known this for a long time with aortic aneurysm repair. And you would never resuscitate a ruptured aortic aneurysm to a normal blood pressure. And I don't know whether it's because of the sort of 50s literature on resuscitation from hemorrhagic shock, or whether it's because of the worry about concomitant head injuries, or it's just become dogma. But now that we actually understand the disease better, now that we understand the consequences of the iatrogenic injury that we inflict by resuscitating, I think it's clear that we just should not be over resuscitating these patients.
Absolutely. Now, what are you doing on your head injuries today?
So head injuries remain a very emotive and difficult area. I personally don't treat them any differently to anyone else, to any of the other patients that we see. So head injury or not, I don't change my target. But there are colleagues of mine who don't agree with that and would much prefer higher blood pressures. And again, I'm not too fussed about that. As long as we're not shooting for normal and we're not giving lots of crystalloid and we are moving in the right direction, you know, I think it's, again, it's more a question of ethos than it is about, having hard and fixed rules about these patients.
Fair enough. Now, my mentor, Richard Dudden, he has developed a personal strategy of resuscitating with blood and FFP as his trauma resuscitation fluid. And when their MAP hits above 65 or so, he gives them a little fentanyl to take away their intrinsic sympathetic tone. And therefore, he's creating a low pressure but good flow situation. And he's attempting to counter the coagulopathy of trauma by getting perfusion to the tissues. What do you think of that strategy?
I think, it's one that has a lot of common sense principles behind it. But again, until you do the study, it's just an idea. And, we know that there's lots of things potentially that the sympathetic system can be doing to exacerbate things like coagulopathy and organ ischemia. But actually whether a sort of fentanyl-based anesthetic obviates that or doesn't produce things like cerebral edema, which would counteract the things that you are trying to avoid in the first place, we just don't know. And so I think you have to do the study these days, and that's the problem.
So what have we discussed so far? Dr. Brohey, like most of the cutting-edge trauma surgeons, believe that even though the literature base is not fantastic, you should not be resuscitating these patients to a normal blood pressure. And he mirrors what Rick Dudden has been saying, which is it doesn't matter if they have a head injury or not. Treat them the same because that's what's going to benefit them in the long term. Do not resuscitate to normal or high blood pressures, even with concomitant head trauma. And again, the literature is not great, but that just seems to be the best thing we have going right now from what we could extrapolate from the existing literature. Again, I highly recommend checking out Dr. Brohey's talk on hypotensive resuscitation linked in the show notes. Let's go to the next topic. I want to jump, if we could, to traumatic arrest because I've gotten a ton of listener questions and folks are very confused because they hear one thing from one set of surgeons, they hear something else from another, and then they talk to trauma surgeons. And I think the party line for trauma surgeons is pretty consistent. And so I want to hear it from you directly because your word carries some weight. Is there any role for closed chest massage of a hemorrhagic shock patient?
So I'll say there's no role for closed chest massage for anyone who is in hemorrhagic shock, cardiac tamponade, tension pneumothorax, or any other condition that might cause a reduced preload and therefore reduce filling and therefore make closed chest compression worthless.
So let me just emphasize that to make it absolutely clear. In a patient in traumatic arrest, whether it be from hemorrhagic shock, they've exsanguinated, they have a tension pneumothorax, they have a pericardial tamponade, there is no role for closed chest CPR. Do not do it. This is not a standard ACLS case. Do not do it. Either call the code or open the chest. Do not do closed chest CPR.
That's not to say I think that there aren't some, I think you should be careful in trauma about that. I think you can do, most of the time with CPR, you're doing harm, but occasionally there'll be patients who do need CPR because they've had a medical arrest, and so they had a heart attack which made them crash their car, and they're not actually hypovolemic. The child who is arrested because he's been hypoxic and is not hypovolemic, I guess would be two examples.
So there you go. There's your proviso. If you think the cause of this arrest is medical and then they happen to have a trauma subsequent to that, or one listener wrote in, if you think this is a commodio cordis, or as Dr. Brohey mentioned, if you think this is a hypoxemic arrest from in a child, anything that's not trauma, knock yourself out. That's a standard medical code. But if this is a trauma code, if this is a patient who had a stab wound to the chest, what they do not need is closed chest CPR. What they do need is you to treat them as if they are a trauma.
It's a very emotive environment, and I think unless you've got a hospital team that agrees that CPR is not the right thing to do, then again, I wouldn't necessarily have a fight about it. But I think if you think about it and if you've read about it, you're not doing any good with it, and you're probably doing harm.
Thank you for that. That's going to be very helpful. Now let's move it to a real case and see how you'd handle this. A listener wrote in, patient with a stab wound to the neck, Eventually, it was found that they had lacerated their left IJ, but they didn't know this at the time. Patient had vitals when they arrived in the trauma bay and then lost them in front of them. What would you be doing in that patient?
So he's lost vitals, but he presumed he has pulseless electrical activity on the monitor.
If you want the on the monitor, yes, actually, he has a rhythm. Sure.
Okay. So I would treat that as a traumatic arrest. I would start giving fluids, ideally blood, but whatever you've got available in that situation. So you need to correct a volume issue. You need to exclude attention, and we would do bilateral finger thoracostomies in that patient. And you'd exclude a tamponade by using ultrasound, usually.
So no rush of air on your finger thoracostomies, and there is no fluid surrounding the heart.
And response to fluid resuscitation?
Patient still has not regained pulse.
Well, I guess you're then, and on your thoracostomy, there's no blood come out of the left chest.
Correct. Your presumption now is that this was from exsanguination on the scene.
Well, I mean, the next step, and the only next step, really, if you want to go further, is to open the chest. And the presumption then, essentially, is that you are controlling, you're opening the chest to control, to proximately control hemorrhage from neck vasculature. Again, I think you need to be careful because, you know, you can't actually bleed that much into the tissues of the neck. So if you're not responding to fluid, you either just haven't given enough volume yet, or there's hemorrhage into a body cavity. You know, you can't lose the blood volume into your neck. So, but you've got to chase hemorrhage. So if you need to exclude hemorrhage into the chest, and you need to make sure that you've got enough volume on board, and I would keep giving fluid, I think.
And is there any role for any of the vasopressors? And this is another contested situation. Would you be giving these folks epinephrine? Would you be giving them calcium? Would you be giving them, now there was one article on vasopressin, or would you just go with manual resuscitation?
No, just manual. I think the one thing that we do know from experimental medicine studies is that if you give a hypovolemic patient an inotrope like adrenaline, you immediately deplete the heart of myocardial oxygen, essentially. And you get into a state essentially where the heart becomes unresponsive and unresuscitatable because you have no tissue oxygenation left. So, and there's good rat data on that, there's good pig data on that. And I think giving any sort of vasoconstrictor until you know that a heart is full is the wrong way to go. I'm a fan of giving calcium early before adrenaline. So once you are full, if you do need to restart a heart, you know, the patient who's gone into asystole or some sort of agonal rhythm or is just not kicking in, then I'll give calcium first and then do things like correct potassium and things and then adrenaline. But I won't give it till the heart's full.
Fair enough. Would you bother cross-clamping this patient?
Yes, I think, well, we don't cross-clamp per se because, you know, it's the reality is that you can't unless you take a lot of time over it. But we would, you know, I'd get someone to hold a fist against the aorta, against the spine, and just help with volume to more rapidly volume load.
Fair enough. All right, so I don't want to take too much more of your time, so let's move on to the last topic of massive transfusion. Are you using any scoring systems, or are you just doing gestalt to decide which patient needs massive transfusion activation?
So our criteria for activating our major hemorrhage protocol is blood pressure less, systolic blood pressure less than 80, not responding to small volume fluid resuscitation, and that the clinician who's treating suspects that this is a hypovolemic hemorrhagic shock and not some other form of shock, and then they have to activate.
When are you adding transoxamic acid to the mix now?
So we give it to everybody who is at risk of hemorrhage, essentially. So we follow the CRASH II guidelines, essentially to the letter. Inclusion criteria, essentially to the letter.
Fair enough. So basically any patient bleeding from trauma is getting TXA.
Any patient bleeding or at risk of bleeding, actually, which is as the study inclusion were. I think, you know, we'll hopefully see some more information coming out which will refine that, but at the moment there doesn't seem to be any reason not to follow the CRASH II data.
And are you folks using TEG or Rotem to guide your resuscitation?
We are not yet. It is a big research area of ours, and we have it in our emergency department as part of a research program. We are essentially trying to come up with an evidence-based algorithm using an observational study before we actually use it to guide our clinical resuscitation. I think it's always going to be some sort of hybrid between an empiric treatment first off and then moving to a TEG-guided thing, and how we actually do that is hopefully something that we'll have some beginning answers to within the next 12 months or so.
Fantastic. Are you using any hypertonic?
No, we only use hypertonic saline for the traumatic brain injuries who have localizing signs, and as a bridge to CT and surgery. So it's a brain injury thing rather than a resuscitation fluid.
And then why don't we finish off by you telling us a little bit about Cryostat?
So Cryostat is a clinical trial that we are just starting, which is basically comparing standard treatment to giving high dose early cryoprecipitate as a first line treatment. And the rationale for it essentially is based on some work that we've published looking at fibrinogen levels and basically showing that fibrinogen levels essentially are the ones to fall first in trauma, and probably therefore the ones that you should be replacing first, as it is a key substrate for clot formation. And so the Cryostat's a pilot study essentially to see whether we can deliver Cryostat easily and get some baseline efficacy data. We're hoping to recruit about 50 patients. It's actually a joint study between the UK civilian sector and the UK military. So patients are being or will be recruited both in London, in Oxford, and in Camp Bastion in Afghanistan. And amazingly to me, it seems to me that it's the first ever randomized controlled trial that's been done jointly between civilian and military anywhere. Yeah, which is quite shameful, actually, if you think about it. But anyway, hopefully it'll take us about 12 months to get some preliminary data out of that. And then we'd like to move on to a full-scale study and see really whether, you know, makes more sense to give a high fibrinogen load early rather than focusing, say, on plasma or other transfusion strategies as a first line.
Now, is this because you don't have the availability of fibrinogen concentrate that you're going with the cryo?
It's twofold. One is fibrinogen concentrate is not licensed for adult acquired hemorrhage in the UK. We had considered going straight to a fibrinogen concentrate trial, but it would be a lot more expensive for us. And this is something that we can essentially fund off our own back. And the second reason is, we're used to using cryo, number one, and there's a lot of stuff that's in cryo that's not in fibrinogen concentrate. And again, we have some, I'd say, case-based data to suggest that they're not the same thing. And so we're starting with Cryostat in a small feasibility trial, hopefully getting some other information on the difference between cryoprecipitate and fibrinogen from other studies. And then we'll see where that takes us for a bigger trial later.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, to close, are there any words you'd like to say to emergency physicians?
I think I would suggest that both emergency physicians and trauma surgeons should get over themselves and stop worrying so much about specialty boundaries and actually respect what each other do and come up with combined protocols that work. And I think that's the key difference between mature trauma system and a rather immature practice. And only in that way really move things forward.
I think those are ideal words to end on. Well, I can't thank you enough, Karim. This is fantastic.
No, thanks, Scott. Thanks for inviting me.
So there you go. An interview with one of the masters of trauma, Karim Broey. Check out the show notes for all sorts of links to articles and that lecture we mentioned on hypotensive resuscitation and a whole bunch of other stuff. If you aren't attending, there is no reason you shouldn't get CME for having listened to this. So go to cme.mcrit.org or mcrit.org/CME and check it out. See if you want credit for listening to this episode. Well, I'm going to stop there. This is Scott Weingart from the MCRIT podcast saying...